Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage takes the frustrations out of getting a mortgage by letting you safely share your financial information with the touch of a button. Get approved online in minutes at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Several hundred thousand people each year die from infections resistant to antibiotics. Our guest this hour is looking to the natural world, to Brazilian pepper trees, water lilies, and sweet chestnuts for alternatives to modern medications. This is not quackery. She's approaching this as a scientist, a university professor. This hour on Point, unlocking the power of plants. You can join us on air or online. Do you worry about superbugs, about drug-resistant infections? Did you ever imagine plants could be drugs of the future? Does this sound a little bit too out there for you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Atlanta, Georgia is Cassandra Quave. She is an ethnobotanist, curator of the Emory University Herbarium, professor of dermatology and human health at Emory. She was profiled in a New York Times Magazine piece this weekend headlined, "Could Ancient Remedies Hold the Answer to the Looming Antibiotics Crisis?" You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Cassandra Quave, welcome to On Point. So great to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So you've described ethnobotany as the science of survival. What does that mean? What is ethnobotany?
Right. Well, ethnobotany is the study of the relationships that people have with plants, and that might pertain to the way that people use plants to build their homes, to create clothing, the use of plants for food, for medicine, for tools. It's basically the study of any use of plants and for ritual and so on.
What's the practical application of that in a medical sense?
Well, in a medical sense, we're interested in those plants that are being used for both human and veterinary medicine in traditional forms of healthcare.
So the statistics reveal that about 700,000 people die every year because of antibiotic resistance. In fact, the United Nations is meeting this week in New York to talk about that issue as a public health threat. Talk about your assessment as an ethnobotanist about this antibiotic resistance today and how that's threatening us as a people.
That's right. So today they estimate, like you said, around 700,000 deaths globally due to antimicrobial resistance. And those estimates are set to rise to around 10 million a year by the year 2050. Tomorrow, actually, heads of state and leaders of different delegations will be discussing this at the UN General Assembly. And hopefully this will lead to the creation of a declaration. I think this is an important turning point in global engagement in addressing this problem. This is a problem that affects everybody. Antibiotics, the introduction of antibiotics, really marked a turning point in human medicine and our ability to provide care through surgery, childbirth, many, many different forms of medical care dependent on antibiotics. And it's scary that we're starting to lose the ability to use these because of resistance.
A new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association actually shows that doctors today are more frequently prescribing third and fourth generation drugs that have been typically used as sort of a last resort medications, if you will, to treat resistant infections. What does that say to you?
It says that we are running low on our options. I think that it also points out one of the major problems in the antibiotic pipeline is that we're relying on those third and fourth generation drugs instead of really moving forward novel chemical candidates and perhaps exploring more alternative approaches to addressing this problem.
So how do you see ethnobotany playing a role in treating antibiotic-resistant infections? How might some of the ancient remedies that you're looking at become the drugs of the future?
Well, ethnobotany and pharmacognosy, which is a study of medicinal products from the natural world, has long been a source of important pharmaceuticals. There are many examples of drugs that we use every day that originated from nature, from plants and fungi and even soil microbes.
So, but what is it about the plants that hold that key? What is it about them?
Well, plants have a unique ability to create a vast array of chemically interesting compounds. These are called secondary metabolites. Secondary metabolites are made by plants because they aren't able to move away from threats or towards resources. So this is a sort of chemical arsenal that they produce to respond in defense against pathogens that would attack them, or to compete with other organisms in the environment for resources, to attract pollinators, to attract seed dispersers. So it's really their chemical language that allows them to navigate their environment.
So the chemical language of plants has the same impact as an antibiotic would. It just works in a different way?
Kind of. So a lot of these plant chemicals are not necessarily antibiotics in the classic sense that you would think about. You know, they're not necessarily going to kill bacteria, but they might be able to work by diminishing the threat. So some of the compounds that we've been working on, for example, we've been able to show that they can actually disrupt the ability of bacteria to communicate with one another. And I like to explain this. It's kind of like taking the teeth out of the dog's bite, right? So by using these compounds, we can attenuate virulence or take away their weaponry. And while they're growing in the host, it gives the host an immune response, a better chance at clearing out that infection. Or it could allow, you know, other existing lines of antibiotics to perhaps work more efficiently on that target.
How'd you get interested in this?
I've been interested in science my whole life. I kind of, I think it was described a little bit in the article, but I grew up in a rural community and spent a lot of time outdoors, you know, covered in dirt and exploring the natural world. And, you know, I suffered from a bacterial infection of my leg following my amputation. So it personally impacted my health from a young age. And I actually really got into microbiology and the study of antibiotic resistance through school science fair projects. I'm a big supporter of science fair. It really helped me to gain the skills and confidence to pursue a life in science later on in life.
Over the past 5 years or so, you've been gathering hundreds of therapeutic shrubs and weeds and herbs, all for chemical analysis. What exactly are you looking for? What have you found?
Right. So we're looking for new compounds, things that are chemically unique. We're looking for things that could either kill bacteria or could interrupt their communication pathways. So again, looking at alternative ways to reestablish balance. You know, not all bacteria are bad. In fact, the vast majority are actually quite good and necessary for your health. And when you take kind of a carpet bombing approach, where you're just wiping out all the flora on any part of the body, that's not necessarily good for you. So we're looking at compounds that can perhaps be more specific in targeting the bad bacteria and reducing their ability to create harmful toxins or reducing their ability to stick to things. So some of our recent discoveries that are in the literature now, you can read about on my website, include the discovery of biofilm inhibitors from a blackberry from southern Italy. So this was an interesting story because this is a plant that's used. It's the fruits are eaten, as just like we would use blackberries here. They're eaten raw or they're used to make marmalades and desserts. But the leaves were applied topically with a little bit of pork fat to the skin to treat abscesses. And the roots were used in a kind of wash to treat hair loss. And for this reason, I collected both the leaves and the roots and some other parts of the plant to evaluate the chemistry and the bioactivity. And what was interesting is that, indeed, in the leaves, while we did not find the growth inhibitory properties we would typically look for in slowing down the growth or killing the bacteria, what we did find are compounds that are able to prevent them from sticking to surfaces. And we further found even greater levels of these compounds in the roots. So to think about what is a biofilm, if anybody's ever looked in, you know, maybe a your bathtub or a drain that hasn't been cleaned in a while, it's that kind of slimy material that's formed by microorganisms. And it really confers something we call intrinsic resistance. So you think about it like a shield that the bacteria are able to hide in, and their growth actually goes into a slower level of growth and division, which makes them difficult to target with antibiotics. So they use this physical barrier to both, you know, hide out and avoid attack from the immune system if they're in a host, or from other compounds like antibiotics. They just can't reach the cells as efficiently as they could if they were floating about on their own in a host.
Slows them down.
Slows them down and makes them stronger.
So I hear your scientific explanation, and I was going to ask you, what do you say to people who put this work into the category of sort of voodoo medicine? You know, plants, schmants, you know, I need my antibiotics. You know, some people are quite skeptical of this sort of thing. What do you say to them?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think it's important to, again, realize that many, many of our pharmaceutical drugs were derived from nature, and many of those from plants. If you've ever been to the dentist office and had a numbing shot before you had some dental work done, you can thank a plant for that. That comes from, you know, the coca plant. The same source of cocaine is also the source of derivatives that were developed to as local anesthetics. If you've ever had surgery and you've had morphine following the surgery to help in your recovery, thank a plant for that. If you've ever taken an aspirin, thank a plant for that. The list goes on, and this extends into many other fields, including cardiology. Patients take plant-based drugs for congestive heart failure, especially relevant in cancer. And I think there's much we still have to learn from these natural resources.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about plants and ancient traditions of using them for medicinal purposes. It's the sound of the Amazon rainforest in the morning. My guest, Cassandra Quaith, has gone to the Amazon to learn about how people there use plants to heal. And you can join the conversation. Are you already sold on natural cures? Do you use plants to heal yourself, to treat burns or a cough? Is this out of your comfort zone? Cassandra Quaith is with us from Atlanta this hour. She is an ethnobotanist at Emory University, curates the herbarium there, and you can find photos of some of the plants she's collected and researches on our website, onpointradio.org. In May, CNN reported that a 49-year-old Pennsylvania woman had a superbug E. coli bacteria that is immune to antibiotics.
There were many different classes of antibiotics to try and treat E. coli. Not just antibiotics, but entire classes of antibiotics. At least seven of those classes exist. And what we now know is that this particular woman has a bacteria, this E. coli bacteria, that does not respond to any of those antibiotics.
Becoming more and more common, Cassandra Quaith. I've read about the father of modern ethnobotany, Richard Schultz. He spent 12 years living alongside indigenous people in the Northwest Amazon Basin, participating in their rituals and their indigenous therapeutic plants, ingesting some of them as well. Take us into some of the cultures you've researched. You spent time in the Amazon as well as many other places. Throw something out at us. Where'd you go and what'd you find?
Great. So, yes, Richard Evan Schulte is kind of known as the father of ethnobotany and did some really amazing work in his time throughout the Amazon. And following in his footsteps, I've gone to a number of different places. So I started off as an undergraduate student with some time in the Peruvian Amazon, where I learned about medicinal plants used for a number of conditions. I was most captivated by the use of a local fig known as oje. The scientific name is Ficus insipida. It was a great example of how Western medicine in some cases can displace traditional medicine and lead to unforeseen consequences. So in this case, people had forgotten how to actually use this plant appropriately, even though it was abundant in many of the villages, and the healer's knowledge was being lost. And this was once used to treat childhood helminthic infection or intestinal worm infection, which they're constantly exposed to through drinking river water and also by walking barefoot in the area. And so what happened is you ended up with kids that carried heavy loads of these worms and were anemic and suffered from other respiratory problems. So that's kind of what got me really interested in ethnobotany, is thinking about here we stood surrounded by a forest full of remedies that had been successfully used to manage health in the past, but which had been displaced by Western medicine. And when Western medicine left the region, there was nothing to fill that void. So following my work in the Amazon, I met another scientist, Professor Pironi, who's now in University of Gastronomic Sciences in Italy. And I joined his team to research traditions in southern Italy. So it was quite a leap from the Amazon to Italy, but it's one that was just life-changing for me because I got to work with a really skilled team and gain additional skills in ethnobotanical interview techniques and plant collection and so on.
How were the traditions different from Peru to Italy? What did you notice?
Well, you're not quite as embedded, obviously, in nature as you are in the Amazon, where you're really living within a very natural habitat. But in rural villages in Italy, it's still quite common, even today, to use a lot of plant-based medicines. There are a lot of wild plants that are wild-crafted for herbal teas, especially to manage respiratory infections. There are a lot of wild foods that are still collected and that represent a really important part of their food culture still today. These traditions, unfortunately, are becoming slowly lost as some of the most elder members of these communities pass away. If they're not maintained from generation to generation, these memories and practices can be lost over time.
A lot of calls. Let me get John in here from Ashtabula, Ohio. Hi, John. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Yes.
So my wife and I run a small herb farm in northeastern Ohio, and we're finding that we're able to use a lot of those herbs for medicine. We sell a lot of plants, but we're also finding that there's all kinds of plants that can be used for fibers for creating clothings and linens, like flax and nettles, and there's dye plants, and there's plants that bring us food, of course. And there's all these different arrays of plants that come from different regions all over the world. Now, one of the things that we've noticed with this is that many of the most potent medicinal plants also are invasive species. For example, where I live, the autumn olive is an invasive species, but it also has 10 times the lycopene of tomatoes. So those secondary metabolites that your guest was talking about, very high in those. Also, the dandelion, extremely medicinal and prolific everywhere, medicinal and also an invasive plant.
Oh, that's interesting, John. Thank you. Cassandra, have you found that, these invasive species? Are some of the most potent?
Absolutely. He really hit the nail on the head. It's funny, I was walking through Emory's Low Water Forest the other day with a ecologist here, and you know, he was talking about trees and, you know, saying, I speak for the trees, you know, like in the Lorax. And I said, well, I speak for the weeds because the weeds really, time and time again across the globe, we find that those weedy species that you might find growing in wall crevices or very close to the village in kind of disturbed sites near where land is being tilled for agriculture, that's often where we find a lot of these medicinal species. And it's great because, you know, for access when you need them, they're close by. But I think it, like the guest said, is that it or like the caller said, is that it absolutely has a lot to do with their chemistry and their ability to outcompete other species for those resources. They do have perhaps some more useful secondary metabolites.
John, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Daniel in Boone, North Carolina. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane and Cassandra.
Hello. Go ahead.
I'm currently building essential oil extraction processes, and I was wondering what extraction methods are being used for this type of antibiotic plant treatment, and what are preferred methods that you're seeing in the industry.
So how do you extract components from plants? How do you actually do that, Cassandra?
That's a great question. So what we do first is we go back to the ethnobotanical knowledge. We look at how people are actually extracting the active principles in their forms of traditional medicine. Your secondary metabolite contents were going to differ greatly even between different plant parts. You're going to have different compounds in the leaves versus the roots versus the fruits. Also, you're going to extract different types of compounds depending on which solvents you use or which system you use. As you can imagine, in most places, the most common forms of extraction might be through infusions or decoctions, either soaking in hot water or boiling in hot water, or by steeping them in some organic solvent like your, you know, just an average drinking alcohol. So in the laboratory, we make aqueous extractions by decoctions, by boiling it in water. We also steep them in organic solvents such as methanol or ethanol. In some cases, we also extract essential oils through steam distillation or water distillation processes. On an industrial scale, they may use these processes. They may use sonication or high-frequency shaking of the materials to increase the efficiency. There's also something called supercritical fluid extraction that uses kind of a high pressure system to extract these as well. But for the purposes of our lab, the most efficient and low cost method that we use is by steeping in organic solvents and by boiling in water. And that, I think, is what most closely follows what's being used in traditional medicine. Mm.
Daniel, thanks so much. What a great question. The FDA, Cassandra, has an approval process specifically for botany-based medicine. But as I understand it, only about two of these drugs have been approved so far. What's the process require in that? How do you go about that?
Great. So it's very similar to approving a regular single compound pharmaceutical with a few exceptions. The botanical drug pathway allows for approval of plant materials that have a long demonstrated use in traditional medicine. That can help in showing that it's grass or generally recognized as safe and that it has been used for a long time by humans. Secondly, these products have to be reproducible and authenticated. You have to show that you're actually using just this one specific species, that it's not being confused with any other species. Obviously, that could lead to bad health consequences. Mm-hmm. That's also an issue faced in the dietary supplement industry. A lot of attention paid to authentication of your materials.
Mm-hmm.
And you would need to identify something they call marker compounds. These are basically chemicals in the extract that, you know, a plant extract could contain hundreds to thousands of compounds. Typically, in this botanical drug pathway, perhaps they're more refined to contain less compounds. It's more specific for that bioactivity. And so you would want to control from batch to batch that you actually have a reproducible product based on the consistency and level of these compounds.
Let me ask you a very practical question. What do you do if you're a parent and your child, for example, is diagnosed with an ear infection? And this is the fourth ear infection in 3 years, and I don't want to put them on yet another round of antibiotics. What do I do? What's the mechanism to move away from antibiotics, knowing that my child needs to be treated, needs to have appropriate treatment, but I want to go in a different direction? How else do I do it?
Well, one of the major complications with recurrent ear infections and with many other recurrent infections is the presence of a biofilm. Again, biofilms are very resistant to therapy. I can't really give medical advice on which plants to use, but I would say on a broader sense, this is an area that we need to put more focus and attention on in our area of biomedical research to develop products that could help those antibiotics to work better even in a biofilm context. And this is where natural products from plants that actually specifically block the formation of biofilms perhaps might play a very important role if given in combination with antibiotics to clear out completely that infection so that you don't have that chronic recurrence.
Let's go to Kent in Breckenridge, Colorado. Hi, Kent. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Okay, my family had an interesting experience a couple years ago in Costa Rica. We were spending a few months down there as a family, and you were talking about ear infections, and our daughter did develop an ear infection while we were in Costa Rica. We went back and forth to the local doctor and were prescribed several different antibiotics over a period that ended up lasting 6 weeks. And rather than ever getting better, the infection just continued to kind of get worse and worse, and we became more and more worried about permanent damage, permanent hearing loss. We made calls to our pediatrician back in the United States, and she advised us, you know, continue to do what the doctors there are telling you. And eventually we ended up with lab tests that showed that she had developed a resistance to all the antibiotics that they had given her, as well as several others. And so they told us there was one last ditch effort that was a very strong antibiotic that had to be administered through an injection twice a day for 10 days. Mm. And that just caused a lot of distress to my 9-year-old daughter as well as to us as her parents. And we were talking about that with a friend, an ex-Bate American that lived in the area full time. We were just visiting, and he suggested at that time, you know, why don't you take a trip and visit the indigenous medicine man? We were on the coast, but the jungle was right there. And at that recommendation, you know, our first response was, you know, thinking, well, we're not really that sort of people. You know, we prefer our Western medicine, and that's always served us well. We consulted again with the doctor there in the town, and they said, you know, if you want to try that, we wouldn't hold out any hope for it, but if you want to try that for a few days, you can, before you go on this really strong antibiotic. Mm. We went up and visited the indigenous medicine man. You were talking earlier about steeping these various plants. He basically made a tea that was steeping different types of local plants and bark, and kind of let me watch as he was doing this. My daughter was kind of nervous about this. Luckily we speak Spanish, and the indigenous there, some of them speak Spanish, and he did, so we were able to communicate. And he made up a tea, and he also made a paste from some various plants, and the prescription was, you know, drink this tea twice a day and put this paste in around the outer edge of her ear at night before she goes to sleep. And 6 weeks we were on antibiotics with no results, and in 6 days her ear infection was better using the natural local treatment. And we went to see the local doctor there, and they were amazed. They said, you know, whatever you're doing, it's gotten way better, and keep doing it. And within 6 days, it was cleared up and gone. Mm,
what a great story, Kent. Thank you so much for calling. We're skeptical, aren't we, Cassandra, to move away from traditional treatments. I get it. My dad's a doctor. I'm steeped in the traditional way. But how do we make that shift? I mean, you hear Kent's story and you think, he's onto something.
Listening to his story, it just brought to mind one word, and that's synergy. I think that this is something that can be scary in the terms of developing these drugs because it's so complex. But one of the benefits we have from plant-based medicines is that we're not dealing with a single compound hitting a single biological target. In many cases, we have many compounds, perhaps acting on a number of different targets that can sometimes elicit, you know, a cure or the desired outcome. It is highly complex. We need more research and trying, you know, support to figure out how to best study these higher order levels of complexity so that we can make advances in medicine, looking back at some of these old traditions and the knowledge that they offer.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using a phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinance in just a few minutes. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the rich, ancient tradition of looking to plants for healing. You can join the conversation. What's your question? For our ethnobotanist, have you come up with your own natural solutions? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're speaking with Cassandra Quave this hour, an ethnobotanist out of Emory University. She curates the herbarium there, and you can find some photographs of her plants, the ones she's been researching, at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's Dr. Chio Torres, the Vice President for Student Affairs at the University of New Mexico. Grew up learning about the history of traditional healing in Mexico. In 2013, he gave a TEDx talk about the folk traditions of Mexico, connecting modern medicine to traditional healing. He said that when he was diagnosed with diverticulitis and was going to have surgery, he turned to the Mexican tradition of healing.
So immediately I got on the phone. I called Rita, my curandera friend from Mexico. I said, Rita, I'm having surgery. She said, no, you're not. She said, take papaya. 3 times a day if you have to. I said, that's what my mom used to say. And she said, did you listen to your mom?
Cassandra, great question from Twitter here. Can your guests talk about the issue of keeping these plants and those that use them from being exploited and over-harvested?
That's a great question. Yeah, so there are some really important principles to ethnobotanical research that we follow. Number one is the Nagoya Protocol and the Convention on Biological Diversity. So this this protocol is basically provides guidance to scientists and to industry in how to prevent exploitation of indigenous people and to work to develop tools for access and benefit sharing. So access and benefit sharing may take many different forms. The kind of work we're doing right now, you know, we're not bringing in millions of dollars to bring back to communities. Mm-hmm. But there are ways we give back already. So one important way, I'll give you an example of what we did in southern Italy, is that we were able to apply for EU grant funding to build an ethnobotanical garden in one of the communities that we worked in. And I also wrote a book on the traditional knowledge that we documented, both in Italian and English, and also with the their local dialect, names of the plants that were supported through this EU project and then distributed free of cost to all the different communities that were involved in the study. And it was a great example of a way to help promote conservation of this knowledge by taking, you know, the grandparents' quotes and information about the local plants and then distributing that to the communities and to their grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Mm. And that was really great. For other future endeavors, basically one of the tools that can be used are platforms that also the National Cancer Institute used, which is an agreement to come to an agreement should these technologies be later selected for development, for drug development, so that there's also financial sharing with both the knowledge holders in general and also individual healers that made meaningful contributions to the research. Mm. Conserving over-harvesting, and this is something I want to clear up about the article, too, because it ended with, you know, grab all you can.
Right.
For those of you that
right,
are not
you're out
botanists,
in the field grabbing yeah. your shrubs and your weeds and your therapeutic
yeah.
herbs, right?
So plantain is a super, super, super common weed that is found everywhere. So this was in no way a threatened population of plants, and we are very careful to follow the WHO guidelines on good collection practices for medicinal plants, which has certain guidances like, you know, not collecting in areas that have been exposed to possible pollutants or road runoff or runoff from agricultural zones, not over-harvesting things that are rare or threatened or very small populations of plants.
So there are certainly guidelines,
Yeah, these are things that we follow very carefully. There are also a lot of rules about movement of plant specimens. There are a lot of permits required for importing specimens. And the USDA is rightfully, has these regulations to ensure that, diseases from introduced by plants coming from other countries that we're studying don't spread and have any impact on the environment or agriculture.
Great question from Twitter. I'm going to move on here. Thank you so much. I got to get more listeners in because we got a lot of great calls. Megan is in Little Chute, Wisconsin. Hi, Megan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Jane. And thanks for talking about this. I think it's a really important topic that, a lot of people are nervous about, but you're talking about the traditional medicine, the original medicine. I just wanted to comment that, one, this awareness that you're bringing about is so essential. This past weekend, over 2 days, I sustainably harvested 40 pounds of wild food. I have 40 pounds of free wild food in my kitchen. It's better than organic. As long as we know how to do it sustainably and responsibly, there's so much available. One of the things I harvested specifically is called hen of the woods mushroom. And there have been studies in the U.S. and Japan that have found that it's a very, very powerful anti-HIV, anti-bacterial, anti-fungal food that, obviously there needs to be more research done. But the other thing I did want to point out, too, that as an herbalist, as a health practitioner, as a foraging guide, what I've learned and what I've experienced is that it's so important to get these foods and herbs in their whole form. And I know that's not something the pharmaceutical industry likes because they like to isolate, the salicin from white willow bark, for example, because you can standardize it, you can patent it. However, it's not going to work the same because you have hundreds of synergistic chemicals in these plants that work together and that make them safer, more effective.
That's a good point, Megan. Thank you. The whole plant is what you want, right? That's what's safer. That's what works, Cassandra?
It really depends on a case-by-case basis, but she's absolutely right that synergy plays a huge role. I think that in the article it was touched on also the resistance to artemisinin that we're now seeing. Artemisinin was isolated from sweet wormwood, which was a plant used in traditional Chinese medicine for fever disease, was then used in the development of this anti-malarial drug. But now that we have resistance, many people are looking to study, can we restore efficacy by looking at the whole herb? And indeed, there have been some very compelling animal studies showing that the traditional preparation, which involves steeping the plant in cool water, does restore efficacy. So another example of how traditional knowledge can play an important role. And I absolutely agree with all of her comments about the need for sustainable harvest. And also, I think it's important to note that it's fantastic that she knows how to go out and collect wild foods. One of my other passions is really supporting education in botany. It's unfortunate that across the country, we've seen closures of botanical programs and even courses being offered in traditional field botany. And I can't emphasize enough how important this is as a field to continue supporting research and education, starting, in elementary school, even with small school gardens is a great way to get kids engaged. But we really need to do a better job at connecting people with nature.
Megan, thanks so much for the call and enjoy that 40 pounds of wild food. That's amazing. Betsy in Knox, Maine, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Hello.
Cassandra and Jane. I just wanted you to talk. A little while ago, you said something about the FDA had only approved two plant-based medicines. And I would like Cassandra to speak a little bit about the intersection of big pharma and plant-based medicines and the FDA and the revolving door of bureaucrats between the FDA and big pharma. And I will go ahead and hang up. Thanks.
Betsy, thanks. How about big pharma? How do they view your work? Is it a threat? Is it complementary? How does it all fit together?
I mean, this is a tricky question. I think I have a good relationship with several companies that I've been in communication with. I think that the challenge in general for antimicrobial research is the payment scheme. You know, this is an interesting case for a class of drug because on one hand, you have the need to be cautious and you don't want to have a lot of use of these drugs in order to conserve them. But on the other hand, you know, from a business side, you do want to sell them to make money and make back your expenses it takes to actually develop these drugs. It's a very expensive and lengthy endeavor to develop drugs. And as to the botanical drug pathway, I'm not as versed in all of the political aspects between the FDA and pharma, but I am excited that two drugs have made it through this pathway. There's one that's a mixture of green tea compounds used to treat genital warts topically, and there's another one that comes from a tree from the Amazon known as dragon's blood, and this is used to treat HIV-related diarrhea, and it's taken internally. So we have both a topical and an oral formulation that's come through this process, and my hope that is that we can continue to develop more standardized botanical medicines through this system and improve access to the general public.
Betsy, thanks so much for the call. I want to play this sound from South Africa. The government there is aiming to register and regulate self-described healers, herbalists, midwives, faith healers. This is from the PBS NewsHour. They spoke with this traditional healer, Esengoma, about her practices, which most Westerners would consider superstitious.
Esengoma's main tool is throwing the bones, animal bones, shells, and sometimes other articles. The healers and their patients believe how the bones land is influenced by ancestors who speak through the bones.
If you would have gone to a Western doctor would take an X-ray or
examine you.
You know, this is my tool to ascertain what's wrong with her.
Cassandra, what about regulations? What about distinguishing between, the quacks that are out there and someone who has a real seriousness of purpose?
I think that some of this in the U.S. is regulated. You have naturopathic doctors that are regulated, herbalists that are regulated. I think that some of my bigger concerns really come with mass marketing of certain kind of fly-by-night dietary supplements. Something I want to point out is that not everything that's natural. Everything that's natural is not safe. And beware, buyer beware here, of any products that are sold that promise immediate market effects. So great example of this is herbal Viagra. Over and over again, the FDA has found that these herbal Viagra pills are being sold, marketed as being a total natural herbal supplement, but indeed have been adulterated or contaminated purposely with pharmaceutical versions of Viagra. And this is very dangerous, of course, because people are taking these at who knows what doses and they're not under the care of a doctor. The same also pertains to supplements that promise immediate weight loss or muscle building properties. Basically, anything that's too good to be true usually is. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to be stay informed and be careful that you don't always take these at face value. That said, there are many reputable companies that sell herbal supplements and herbal products that are under very good quality control. And a lot of these products that are in the mainstream market are under study in the lab, in different laboratories globally.
Let's get another call in here. Allie is calling from Farmington, New Hampshire. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, welcome. Thanks.
Yes.
And I just my comment is that I do appreciate your guest's work, and I think it's really important that these medicines be tested and approved properly. But I get the impression that people might get the idea that they should go consult an herbal medicine man as opposed to take medicines that have been tested in double-blind studies and so on. And I think that impression is an irresponsible one to give to viewers, especially when it comes to antibiotics and taking alternatives.
Ali, I got it. Thank you. It's a good point. Cassandra, I'm not sure that's what you're saying. Go get an herbalist to cure your cancer.
Not at all. Yeah. What we're saying is that traditional knowledge of herbal medicine in different indigenous societies or different forms of traditional medicine can be important starting points for the drug discovery process. The products that we're working on are products that, if they're advanced, would go through all of the preclinical steps for study, through clinical trials and so on. So I'm not at all suggesting that you should, abandon Western medicine for your infections and try and self-medicate or pursue these other opportunities. You should always go to your physician. The point here is that here's another avenue, another potential source for chemically novel bioactive compounds that can be developed. And the point I also want to make is that while we may not understand how many of these traditional medicines work at this point, I think in many cases we haven't had the right toolkit to ask the right questions yet. And I think there's much to learn still.
Ali, thanks so much for that call. As we're ending here, last 30 seconds, Cassandra, you've received a $1.8 million grant from the NIH to pursue research. What do you hope to uncover in the next couple of years here quickly?
Great. That particular grant was in the study of the European chestnut and looking for quorum-quenching compounds, which we have been successful in studying and showing that these compounds work in animal models to prevent the production of these staphylococcal or MRSA toxins. And so we're continuing the pursuit of that study and hope that we'll be able to develop something that will be useful in combating antibiotic-resistant bacteria in the future. Mm.
Cassandra Quave, ethnobotanist, curator of the Emory University Herbarium, professor of dermatology and human health at Emory. Really interesting stuff. Thanks so much for coming on today. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation. Listeners, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.